Part 3. Self-realization through snack. Men who achieve, with hands or brain, who rise, who lead, who win, who act, they fight on simple grain, on Quaker oats, to be exact. Quaker Oats Campaign, 1903. Gradually, I began to realize that modern advertising could be seen less as an agent of materialism than as one of the cultural forces working to disconnect human beings from the material world. T.J. Jackson Lear's Fables of Abundance. When did we all get so fucking bored? At 8 a.m., it doesn't smell like a specialty food show. It smells like new car, the off-gassing of 5 straight miles of newly laid, fuzzy gray carpet blanketing this convention center. By noon, the carpet will be speckled with salsa like bird droppings, a walkway of crushed nuts, crumpled cups, and an endless litter of discarded toothpicks covering the ground like industrial pine needles. But at 8 a.m., it is clean and vast and filled with entrepreneurs assembling booths. The sound is the crickets of the marketplace, thousands of boxes being slit open, the crinkling of thick plastic being unwrapped, the sighs of stiff men bending over to lug out product to display, pausing every once in a while to stand back and take a long nasal inhale. It's the smell of raw capitalism, that off-gassing, and the men savor it before pulling out their phones to take a photo of the pristine booth before it gets ruined by the crush. This is the fancy food show. 300,000 square feet of demonstration space, 80,000 products, 47,000 food professionals gathered in a shrine to specialty food. In grocery, specialty has many meanings. Perhaps most expansively, it refers to volume. Specialty retailers focus on goods that don't have large distribution networks, food desired but only selectively, hidden gems meant for sampling. It includes imports, cheeses, chocolates, and preserves that get their distinction by being alien to the domestic market. But in its restless heart, specialty exists for the new, those products more refined, more absurd, or more tantalizing than what's already offered. To me, it's resonant with discontentment, the repetitive opening and closing of the suburban refrigerator door to check to see if anything's changed. Specialty food was our mango salsa. Then it was sriracha everything. Now it's moved on. This year's show is bursting with high-end popcorns and great globs of Greek yogurt, coated over nuts and raisins, slathered on beef jerky, Greek yogurt as magic elixir that enhances anything it touches. By the time this book is out, both these trends will be dated. We'll be onto something new, perhaps birch water, essentially the tapped phloem of birch trees, naturally filtered and sweetened by the tree itself, activated charcoal, or freeze-dried elk. Whatever it is, it will sound vaguely alluring, but require a slight explanation, the twin attributes of successful specialty, mystery and superiority. Above all, it will solve something. Specialty answers those questions you didn't know you were asking. Its value forever related to how unaware you were of the particular problem until the moment you made its acquaintance. In many ways, we are living in the age of specialty. The entire category gesturing towards an authenticity the rest of the food system left behind. The fact that the authenticity itself is so splintered, contradictory, and chaotic is almost incidental to our craving for it. It is personal. One man's specialty is another man's scorn. But like many things personal, the effect of seeing it all smashed side by side in a convention center is vaguely debasing. There are vomitous streams of comfort and nostalgia. Every trope of Americana, mason jars and aprons, bonnets and barns, colliding with equally vomitous visions of the techno future, a sphere of gelato pulled out by tongs from a cauldron of liquid nitrogen, marshmallows cut so aggressively square as if by laser, their form is basically a middle finger to the whole concept of the s'more. And then there are hot sauces. 10,000 little bottles at 10,000 little booths, each with a howling mouth stretched open on the label. Browsing them, sampling in little dots of red and brown, I start to see all these sauces as a stand-in for the whole show. We aren't at a food conference. This is the hive mind of my condiment drawer, a gibbering id of anxiety and acquisition responsible for all those decaying bottles in my fridge. The act of doing the fancy food show is a little like a yuppie Halloween. Each booth has its wares out front and center. You snoot up, make a little chit-chat, and sample. Quinoa crunch bars here. Goat's milk caramels there. All around, big stumbling adults romp along beside you, each with several different branded tote bags looped over their shoulder, asking questions about production, all in continuous nibble. It's gloriously fun at first. Many of the booths are staffed by food temps, my mental term for the particular class of demonstrators for hire ubiquitous here. Usually they hold out little trays for sampling. Occasionally they're involved in something more degrading, like the perky jerky creature who stands confused and swaying at the end of one particular aisle, a few thousand Chipotle mango lime sample bags stapled to his uniform, this anxious, sweating mummy in dried beef fringe. Most booths, however, are staffed by the proprietors themselves. Their reality is still too small to outsource, even as their dreams include selling big to one of the food giants. These small operators are the spiritual center of the fancy food show, looking to monetize the family onion dip recipe or corner the market on some new tropical plant they stumbled on during their 2 years in the Peace Corps, all certain they've cracked whatever code America's snack obsession is conveyed in. I can talk to them forever. The former graphic designer turned chocolatier, the aging mountain man from Oregon whose home, a mountainside ranch settled by his great-great-grandfather, has a freshwater spring he's certain Walmart will want to bottle, the lunatic eyes of a Southern California farmer with an exclusive contract on an aberrant varietal of miniature avocados, dinosaur eggs, he tells me, holding two in his hand, a true game-changer for the way we eat the fruit. My game remains unfazed, but I see something very similar at Trader Joe's a few years later, four to a bag, so perhaps he was onto something. These small-time dreams intersecting with big-time production also provide my first taste of the grocery industry up front and personal. In between the booths, the floor is crawling with groceryman. They are big, chunky Midwesterners, squares in attitude as well as body composition, so overwhelmingly white and male that there's a slightly nostalgic vibe, like we're in a movie about 1950s NASA. They possess the power of acquisition, ask questions about size and scale, taste quickly, perfunctorily, or not at all. I watched them as they patrol the room in clusters, wielding this power, rugby shirt after rugby shirt stuffed into slacks and cinched up with a tan belt. These men typically have hair that blurs the line between crew cuts and balding, and walk with multiple electronic devices clipped to their waists. A collective style that basically serves to broadcast, I'd rather be riding my mower, and or cracking jokes about murdering the guy trying to date my daughter to that guy's face. An industry consultant I meet calls them a dying species, real live dinosaurs of retail, out of touch with themselves only slightly more than they're out of touch with America in general. But as living dinosaurs, they still are a dominant force in this particular epoch and cannot be ignored. They are men who attend lectures on snacktivation, without irony, and who once there take dutiful notes, underlining the phrase, as the person in front of me does at one such lecture, our ultimate goal is to fill the baskets with snacks, healthy and delicious. Or who stand up in sudden inspiration to snap a photo of a PowerPoint slide with nothing more on it than the phrase, eyes are the windows to the soul, the phone is the window to the wallet. What insight did that man gain from that aphorism? And where does that photo go? Is it sent to some corporate overlord? Right-clicked and set as wallpaper? Mulled like a koan when designing a new customer loyalty program? Listening to these men, their way of masking all decisions with good intentions, their confidence in a retail world they view as a natural physical state rather than a moment in time to be upended by Amazon, Jet, and Peapod, teaches me more about the underpinnings of our food system than any amount of prior research. Eventually, I tire of the floor in these groceryman and decide to head off to the nearby education seminars. The seminars are one of the many side activities to break up the trick-or-treating. They offer industry savants the opportunity to engage in the critical issues of the day, say whether paleo is a trend or a fad, or where precisely you should place an end cap for maximum impact. These are issues you and I might have never considered, but here at the Fancy Food Show, they are weighed with a fair amount of rigor and an extreme amount of self-importance, inspiring entire lecture halls packed with the type of visibly enthusiastic, note-scribbling student usually found just in the very front row. Peeking my head into one, I listen as bebimbop is described as very likely to pop in the next few months. This is in 2015, by the way, and the insight is presented via 7-point evidentiary chain by two presenters in horn-rimmed glasses who suffer no fools or questions. They explain the combination of Asian demographics, point one, the economic recession, food trucks, and impoverished Twitter-loving millennials, points 2 through 5, the, quote, value of release, apparently a temporal thing, very 2014-15, point six, along with celebrity chef David Chang, 5.7 all by himself, whose endorsement of the power of Bebim Bop is plunked in the mix like a mic drop, and who is later described as defining my generation, not only around the United States, but across the world, all ensure that Bebim Bop will triumph in the marketplace, and that all of us snacktivators in the audience will be head-in-sand fools if we ignore it when concocting our chocolate bars and popcorn flavors for the coming year. I decide I'm more impressed with David Chang's publicist than any of the particulars of the argument. But what do I know? Bebim Bop. I cheer for Korean grandmothers everywhere. By this point, I'm relieved to see that most of my fellow audience has checked the fuck out and is pawing at phones and or drawing intricate hash mark schemes on their notepaper. I stand up as a man on the mic intones, "You will see sriracha on 80 different products down the center aisle because it has big flavor, because you can pronounce it, because you recognize it, and because of all of those things, everyone is going to latch onto it and make money out of it." Which prompts the woman in front of me to write on her pad in purple ink, "Get money, make it rain." Is she joking? Does she know? It all speaks to a restless culture where every sharp-tasting, semi-exotic flavor that is not outright nauseating will get squeezed until it produces 15 minutes of culinary fame. Seeing it up close, seeing it being channeled by the pros, their hunger behind our hunger, leaves me exhausted. And after fleeing the educational seminars and trawling the main floor for another few hours, popping flaxseed biscuits, rose hip truffles, and the like, I leave the fancy food show into daylight, strapped down by tote bags filled with other tote bags, taste buds burnt, dopamine depleted, slightly bloated, and swearing off everything but plain white rice and non-Greek yogurt for the rest of the week. The condiment that will change your life. But not before I meet Julie. She's standing at a lone, bare brown table in the farthest back corner of the convention center. Behind her, splayed across a red banner in a powerfully awful font, Slossa. Thereupon, a low-res photo of three jars of something. Something yellow and mealy. Something with a tagline, "A bold new flavor, not out to win accolades, but to make the world more delicious." I'm on my final tour, sampling purely out of obligation at this point, trying to meet as many food entrepreneurs as possible, convinced that their journey to populate our shelves is a critical part of this whole shebang. Julie is standing there in front of her table, apron on, hairpin tight, and hands me a paper cup with a little nugget of sausage, topped with a clump of this slossa. I pop the cup like a shot of whiskey. Yummy! Then I reach out to shake a hand already extended. There's just something about the angle of that handshake, down and sharp, the firmness of her grip, like she's trying to choke a fish, and the compact, turbocharged introduction that follows. "Hi, I'm Julie Boucher of Slossa, a woman-owned business that makes the condiment that will change your life." That makes me think, this woman is on a holy mission for a goddamn relish. That's batshit and beautiful, and I need to learn as much from her as I can. As a product, Slossa is as intuitive as it is baffling. It is a coleslaw plus a salsa, jammed together in a single bottle, as well as in a proprietary neologism. It is an odd, slightly off-putting yellow, a yellow that is brethren to the gaudy emerald of ballpark relish, although Julie assures me, almost before I finish asking, that it's an all-natural color, the result of mustard and beta-carotene. In constitution, slossa is largely cabbage, chopped finely so that on the spoon it looks like grits, but in the mouth it has a satisfying crunch. It is cold and sweet and doesn't really have much kick, just a slight tang from the turmeric and vinegar. But this lack of punch actually makes it more appealing as a partner, not less. It's a condiment that knows its place, that doesn't overwhelm. A Midwestern friend, a guy with true tailgate prowess, holds a jar right up to a squinting eye and pronounces it beguiling. A friend from Tennessee requests a jar for himself and says, "Oh, this I can do." But as much as I like slossa, I can't really visualize it on the shelf. It feels like a lost puppy of a product, especially at this show full of market research trends and cutting-edge design. The bottle has the tagline, "The gourmet topping for everything." And if I didn't know better, I could see slossa as consciously edging into that so earnest it's ironic space LaCroix sparkling water seems to have found. But I've met Julie. There's no irony in slossa. It is clumsy and sincere and evinces zero cool. Just an awkward slaw trying every bit as hard as it can. This also describes Julie. In person, she's a burst of energy, mouth racing forward, dense with information, brown hair and center part, always geared up for a meeting, nothing loose or sashaying in looks or personality or mental outlook. Whenever I ask a question, Julie takes a deep breath. She then takes two big steps back to line it up. It's the kindness of context, but also I realize a scrambling to make sure she has it all correct for herself, almost like the OCD ritual of touching 10 things before turning the tap. But then, after setting her stage, after arranging all her grocery facts in order, Julie just goes, spraying information like a rotating lawn sprinkler. Sales figures, trend lines, price points, sources of data, hedges against those sources, hedges against the hedges. She's liable to burst into laughter at her own inside jokes during all this. But it's an odd laughter. Despite all our time together, I never totally cracked the code of Julie's humor. Perhaps she's good-natured without being good-humored. Perhaps she's good-humored without having a good sense of humor. Regardless, the woman loves to laugh, but not always in a way that allows you to laugh along with her. It's a laughter at her own foibles, where you're kind of worried for her, or a laughter at her own effort levels and accomplishments where you're impressed, but not in any funny way, or a laughter at her own sense of surprise that things are working out, as if any other form of acknowledgement would be a jinx. Julie came to food from NASCAR. She knew nothing about the sport. But after taking a marketing course on a college lark and getting nominated for an internship, she found herself immersed on the road 20 weeks a year selling the NASCAR brand. This led to consulting work with General Mills, which wanted to get their food into those NASCAR stadiums, and a growing reputation as someone who would do whatever it took to get something done. She likes to say she's always been a woman in a man's world, which makes navigating both the macho world of NASCAR and the male merchants of grocery easier. When I was born, I already had an older sister, so my dad treated me like a son. He taught me to throw a baseball, but not throw like a girl. I can pitch. We weren't poor. Well, we weren't dirt poor, she continues. We were frugal. Her mother worked in a bakery part-time. Her father worked for U.S. Steel, and later in a second career as a swimming pool contractor in Florida. My parents didn't save for college. It was always on me. It wasn't really something they expected. In high school, Julie spent most of her free time raising livestock for competition. It was part hobby, part business, buying the swine for $50 or $60 a piglet and raising them for sale at $600 or $700 at full weight. One day, after school, before going to feed her pigs, a teacher came up to her. The school needed cross-country runners. It was under-registered, and it seemed like Julie always had extra energy. I had never run before, Julie says. I was the worst girl on the team. But I had this mentality. I might not be a star, but I'm going to work as hard as I can. And sure enough, after the season ended, Julie added cross-country training to her list of chores. The first race of the next season featured Liz Lepacki, current state champion, undefeated, and already the recipient of a full scholarship to the University of Alabama. Julie lined up next to her, trying to learn something about form. When the gun went off, I stayed with her. I'd never been in the lead pack before, so I think, this is cool. Let me stay here as long as I can. Then the pack dwindles. Then I notice she is lagging, and suddenly I just beat her. And here, Julie bursts into tears. I knew the very moment I crossed the finish line, this is going to pay for college. When she tells me this, crying into her hoagie at a small cafe in North Carolina, she starts apologizing immediately. After wiping the tears away, she says, there would be no Slossa if I had not won that race. And this is essential, Julie, a woman who's willing to work hard and who has a gut-level certainty her hard work will pay off. In high school, she sewed her own prom dress and then sewed a second for a friend. She became chapter president of the local 4-H and made enough money raising pigs to buy her first car. When she sold her first house, she was annoyed by the idea of paying agent fees, so she studied up, acted as her own broker, and says she negotiated the highest price per square foot in the area to date. She gets two haircuts a year because she thinks there are better uses for her money. When I ask where the savings go, the answer is always the same. Slossa. Later, she'll call a hot chocolate I buy her when we meet for coffee a frivolous expenditure she wouldn't allow herself. My last vacation was in 2006, she tells me, but it's not the type of thing I keep track of. I'm not the type of person who needs an annual vacation. I enjoy working. Geographically, her home in North Carolina is only about 50 miles from where I first met Lynn Riles, the trucker. And it's hard not to think of these two women, both working 80-hour weeks, their twin beads of faith, and the different ways they're both perceived and rewarded. Oh, I know. I just know that in 5 years, someone will say she had an overnight success, Julie tells me months later. no way. I've been working my ass off at this. Then she looks up. My husband and I see the long term. The short term is just more sacrifice. That's why we haven't started a family. Any money I might make from Sloss is getting reinvested in it. This is my baby right now. Of course, Slossa wasn't always Julie's baby. It isn't her family recipe. There were no picnics where her grandmother doled it out next to 4th of July ribs. No stories of thousands of hours in the home kitchen perfecting the recipe through obsessive tasting and ad hoc focus groups of friends after dinner. In fact, she had no role creating it at all. Like so much in retail food, Slossa features an estranged partnership. These are ubiquitous at the fancy food show. Eerie in-room absences, hovering around origin conversations like phantom limbs, early investors, first believers, or culinary creators, rent off by the confusion and financial reality of bringing a product to market. Slossa as a food was the creation of a gentleman I'll call Jerome Odell, an electrician from Chattanooga, Tennessee. It really was doled out at his family picnics, the pride of his mother, who really did perfect it in the home kitchen, working to get the balance of crunch and sweet and tang that makes Slossa so beguiling. Slossa was her riff on chow chow, an almost vanished southern relish that borrows from Chinese rail workers, Indian chutneys, and French-Canadian slaws, all of which you start to notice in Slossa once you know to look. As an adult, Jerome took the mantle. And when he brought the stuff out for friends, their eyes opened in surprise, gobbling it down, their kindness, polite flattery, or honest-to-God excitement pushing him to make a business out of it. Sometime in 2010, Jerome got in touch with Julie through NASCAR contacts. He hoped she could get his Slossa into Bristol Motor Speedway. At the time, he was leveraging every contact he had, trying to get his baby out into the world. This was the classic food hustle. Going store to store, trying to get bottles on shelves, pleading with buyers to take a taste. But it all led to fairly dismal results. He got a few articles in a few regional papers, but with a full-time job and family, he was hitting the limits of passion without strategy. Julie came down to Chattanooga on his invite. She tried the slaw, thought it tasted pretty good, and sized up the label as terrible, apparently the universal slaw's first experience. But she didn't know what she could do to help. It wasn't being sold in stores, and it wasn't being demoed at farmers markets. The nutritional information wasn't FDA compliant. So she gave Jerome generic marketing advice and assumed she had tasted her last Slossa. But he kept calling, and she kept answering. Soon Jerome invited her back to Tor's production facility. Julie, who had been inside behemoth assembly lines during her time with General Mills, who had watched in hard hat the 10,000 pounds of peanuts per hour being roasted in the Big Daddy roaster at Planters, wasn't sure if he was joking. This was a tiny commercial kitchen. It almost exclusively produced batches of nutrient broth for horses. Jerome talked about it like it was destiny itself. Then he sketched his plans to get Slossa into restaurants. Slowly, Julie got more involved, her curiosity changing into something much more addictive for her. Challenge. Then she was acting as broker, calling stores, harassing buyers, driving hundreds of miles around the state to different retailers. She says, I'd never sold anything in grocery before, but I just felt like I could sell this. When they ran out of samples, she fronted the money for the next production run. Julie won't talk to me about Jerome on or off record. In fact, she refuses to even tell me his name during any of our 3 years of interviews, saying only it's not something she wants to revisit. And Jerome won't even answer the phone when he finds out I'm calling about Julie. Neither will say a bad word about the other, because they won't even say a single word. When I do bring him up on my own during our last interview, her face fades with exhaustion. They're a huge sighs, not performative, but just old-fashioned heartbreak, where Julie looks away, slides her hands along the table, and generally deflates. She'll only say one thing before stopping our conversation. At some point, I realized I had put a lot of money in. Tens of thousands of dollars. I presented him with a 50-50 contract, but then he backed out of it. And I don't know what to do. If I walk away, I lose everything. So I used all of my savings, almost $50,000, everything I'd saved and worked for my entire life, and bought him out. Julie is staring straight down at the table when she says this, and I realize I'm not watching heartbreak, but terror. All of a sudden, she had a product that she didn't have a personal connection to, a terrible label, and a partner who's not interested in investing further. And after putting in enough money so she felt like she didn't have a choice, she put in everything else she had. And then, after reaching that point, she didn't even have that partner anymore. She was about to fail all alone. The long odds of a slow failure. The rate of failure in food is stunning. Graveyards of products buried so deeply under other products, there's no light or air down there. Typically, the failure is a quick financial strangulation, maybe only 6 months to a year before there are any real statistics to document them. Ideas flare up, commercial kitchen space gets rented, a few $1,000s is sunk into packaging and design. Then, lights out. These make up the vast majority of the lucky. They got out before they were allowed to lose big. The reason for these lucky failures are too numerous to fully excavate, like Tolstoy's families, each unhappy in their unique way. Often they're made up of ideas that seem special to their creators, but that the market yawns at. Another salsa, you say? Why? Oh, yours is the best, is it? Best how? Can it last on the shelf better than old El Paso? No? Save it for some hidden gem taqueria then. Or ideas that never really click along all the dimensions needed. Roasted vegetables sound great on paper. They taste like candy, hit all the new trend lines for healthy and paleo. They are an idea that would tantalize a grocery buyer. What harried mom, and even today it is still the harried mom grocery thinks of first, wouldn't snatch a few off the shelves as a quick way to fill out her son's lunch? But look again. Is the packaging there? What about the manufacturing process? How do you prevent it from becoming fibrous mush when shipped and handled? The answer is you don't, and roasted vegetables are destined to stay behind the glass of prepared food with the 40 to 50% markup that entails. Then there are the quick failures that manage to hit everything, differentiated, maybe even innovated, trending, producible, but that stumble when their owners confront the complexity of logistics. Do you know your gross margins or your COGS, cost of goods sold? Do you know what a responsible wholesale price is versus a responsible direct sales price? How quickly can you make product in response to an order? Without effortless answers to these, you're doomed before you even approach a buyer. And so the vast majority of food businesses rip through a few $1,000s before expiring without a trace. It is money spent like a moderately fancy vacation, which is perfect since that's exactly what these ideas are. A trip sans jet plane from real life into the fantasy land of entrepreneurship. From this sea of lucky failure, a slender percent will hatch and grow to the point they can become unlucky. I'm defining this as actually coming face to face with a buyer in a buyer meeting. And it is here that the real struggle of grocery begins. Journey to shelf. Julie's initial burst of energy was focused on transforming slasa from a recipe into a mass producible product. In her mind, this began with the label. The content wasn't FDA compliant, and the design looked like some nightmare wrapping paper, the logo itself holding about 10 different colors swirling around a busy background. Julie hired a local firm to redo it. The result, still amateurish to my eyes, was at least an amateurishness of simplicity. Label in hand, she began to work on a website. She decided she couldn't even approach a buyer until she had built a social media presence for them to Google behind her back. Then she turned to the product itself. This began with her going to a local university to get a schedule process certification. This is a legally mandated review necessary for shelf-stable food. Once she ironed that out, she could begin pricing out production runs, determining her cost of goods, and factoring in the margin added by different distribution channels. Looking at the ingredients, she decided that an artificial yellow dye used in Jerome's product would be a turnoff. Going all the way organic seemed unnecessary. Hot dog eaters, obviously comfortable with their nitrates, probably wouldn't care. But getting to all natural seemed like a helpful advertising hook to hang on the label. Although the term all natural isn't FDA regulated, to my surprise, it isn't meaningless either. Retailers regulate it on their own. And for Julie to sell slasa as all natural, she needed to get the yellow dye out. This turned out to be her first decision in a much longer process, deciding exactly where to target slasa. The customer experience from one retailer to the next is so similar, so standardized with the same basic aisles and shelves, that it's tempting to think of the back end as similar as well. But as a food manufacturer, you learn quickly this is nonsense. Kroger, Aldi, Whole Foods, Costco, your local food co-op, and Walmart do not exist on some grocery continuum, whether from big to small or fancy to bare bones. Instead, each occupies an entirely different niche in the retail ecosystem, offering a whole distribution world onto itself. As a customer, it's hard to fully understand. But if you try to sell to them, get your baby in their stores, you'll find each runs on its own DNA, uses a different network of wholesalers and truckers, employs different types of buyers in different buying configurations with different mandates, takes different margins, and above all earns their profit through different means. Imagine stepping into a series of different kingdoms, each with its own rituals, beliefs, and customs. Footnote. These niches include convenience, like 7-Eleven, traditional supermarkets like Kroger, Safeway, specialty like Fairway, natural like Sprouts, gourmet like Dean and DeLuca, club like Costco, discount like Aldi, e-commerce like Thrive, Amazon. Some, like Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, are explicit matchups, specialty natural and specialty discount, respectively. To a manufacturer like Julie, these differences mean the world. For instance, a specialty store loves trends, employs a relatively large number of buyers to find them, and goes out of their way to make themselves accessible to that hustling food entrepreneur who's rolling around a suitcase full of product. But they also put in small orders, tend to be independent, and do relatively slow business, which means that it's often more helpful to see them as a marketing channel giving you exposure rather than a bona fide way of making money. Convenience, on the other hand, might employ a single buyer for 10,000 stores and cares not for trends. They put in massive orders that require extremely scalable operations, a network of brokers to keep individual stores in check, and a product that ships incredibly fast and far. This will often crush a young supplier who scores a miracle order and then suddenly realizes they cannot keep up with demand. The footnote to the footnote is that just like the ecological world, this is all occasionally punctuated Stephen Jay Gould cum Michael Cullen style by asteroid meets dinosaur level shifts in the industry, which of course is exactly what is happening in our current decade with Amazon, big data, and e-commerce causing upheaval in just about every niche at once and making traditional distinctions less important. End footnote. Thus, your first job, as per the ancient Greeks, is to know thyself and thy product and determine where in the industry you belong. I could put my product in a fancier jar, Julie tells me. I could spend more money on a label. And if I did that, I could probably charge several bucks more per unit for it. But then my market would be those specialty guys. We're driving to her production facility, and Julie's explaining her thinking around the Slossa label, which I finally admit, I still didn't find too compelling. But specialty distribution marks up 25-30% on top of the store. I wanted to avoid those guys at all cost. Also, the high-end market is great, but personally, I want the truck driver who drives Slossa to market to be able to afford it. Also, I like my label. That yellow script catches the eyes. It's a researched fact. And so Slossa seized on this all-natural identity, a slight upsell on relish to appeal to her customers, but without gourmet aspirations or any overt pitch to health. It is a strategically modest place on the shelf that might make a shopper feel slightly better about picking it up without alienating them with any pretensions. Shaping this identity took about 6 months of around-the-clock work, where nothing visible was accomplished, just day after day of continuous small decisions to get the brand ready. There was a learning curve everywhere. It can be the simplest thing, like if you are going to sample at a festival, knowing you need to put a custom 10x10 tent on the to-do list, Julie says. All the details that seem obvious after you actually do them. By 2011, with her label street legal and her product certified for mass production, Slossa was standing on somewhat firmer ground. And so Julie decided it was time to set up a meeting with a buyer. The buyer meeting. Take your notion of good items and throw that out. Ian Keller, co-founder of Peeled Snacks, tells me, these aren't food items. These are packaged goods, not food, food products. Ian is not saying this in the holier-than-thou Velveeta is not cheese sense. After all, his brand, Peeled, offers a line of organic, non-GMO, no-sugar-added fruits and veggies, a blitz of descriptors that make it appear almost comically conceived to answer the current call for real food on shelves. Buyers are looking for something simple, he continues. It's not that they don't want good products. It's that they have other priorities. And what you think of as good might as well be last on the list. Buyers, after all, are middlemen. They have forces above them breathing heavy on their back hair. Yearly sales goals, revenue they need to make to keep their jobs. They want products that will get them there and make them feel safe. In practice, this means consistency uber alles, consistent shelf life, consistent production facilities, and consistent commodity prices that underpin the ingredient list. If your sustainable line caught honey chili salmon jerky jumps up in price $2 per unit each time there's a shortage of line-caught salmon, you're probably not going to make it as an impulse buy. Footnote. Worse, if you haven't done your homework and feature an exciting new ingredient, the goji berry, acerola fruit, moringa leaf, without locking down your supply chain, it's a safe bet you'll be out of business watching from the sidelines as an agribusiness giant gobbles your source of supply, and thus market share, at the exact moment that exciting ingredient starts to prove itself and actually sell. End footnote. That is the background to these meetings. But what actually occurs within them once the door is closed? What should Julie expect? Here is the nervous pitch meeting, old as bartered exchange, updated with the cheap animation of PowerPoint and set in the drab back offices of a grocery store. Those rooms you find after pushing past the bakery into the dirty non-retail space. You enter. The buyer is harried. If it's an independent, it's probably just the two of you hunched around a laptop. If you're pitching in the corporate offices for a chain, you'll get the glory of a projector. Regardless, the presentation gives a concise explanation of your product, highlighting its 8 to 12 sell points, those factors that distinguish it from all others, explaining why it deserves space on the shelf, why it is priced to make the buyer money, and why it upsells, outsells, or outshines the current competition. But this presentation is perfunctory. The follow-up questions are where deals get made and lost. And here, it gets awkward. The merchant-supplier negotiation is one of the great bastions of subtextual conversation, Ian says. People are saying words, but nobody really knows what those words mean or why those precise ones are being spoken. It's a subtle probing for information, of half steps, a giant butt-sniffing, a buyer tells me, like two dogs in the park circling each other, trying to figure out if they each have what the other wants. There are always two levels of conversation, Ian explains. You can try to be as frank as you want, but there is an industry-wide attitude that if you give up information, you lose something. So nobody wants to be perceived as giving up anything, even though obviously you have to for the conversation to make sense at all. Most of the questions are about sussing out needs. A buyer asking, what type of lead time do you need, might translate to acknowledgement that he's being pushed by corporate for rapid change, while also giving him plenty of space to politely decline an answer unless it hits his price. A supplier asking, what do you see happening in the category, might be trying to figure out the weak brands that are being replaced, allowing her to reposition her pitch on the fly and target those cubic inches. Or the questions might be bananas and come from a place of total ignorance. These guys live in grocery stores, another entrepreneur tells me. You think that they'd have their finger on the pulse, but for a lot of the older guys, it's just the opposite. Half the time, it's vertical pressure from their boss who just finally heard about coconut water and wants them to get on it. Or maybe they just took the meeting to get intel on a competing chain, and they are poking around to see what other places you're stocked and what margin that guy takes. The first time I went into a buyer meeting, I was sweating. I was nervous, Julie says. Do I just sit and go through a PowerPoint presentation with them? Instead, I'm running around serving food. I want them to try it, but that feels awkward. Am I really feeding these guys who speak in numbers? Nowadays, I just think be passionate. You're selling yourself and what you can do as a marketer. These subtextual conversations can go on for months. A supplier for Trader Joe's talked about agreeing to a price with the chain within 10 minutes, but then entering a six-month extended negotiation on the specifics of the product itself, replacing a sugar alcohol sweetener with real sugar, coming up with a slightly more rustic look for the box, and only then, once all the details were worked out, at his expense, did Trader Joe's come in with an order? Or not? A corporate buyer for Safeway asked Julie to send samples to every single one of his category managers and every single grocery manager at every single division. He loved Slossa, swore he had a jar in his home fridge, and told her he was going to introduce it at one of his conference calls. Julie wrote an entire presentation for him to introduce the product there. When I see her more than 2 years later, she is still waiting. No movement, no word. No new product in stores. To make sense of these delays, both the hesitations and outright disappearances, understand how overwhelmed buyers are. A single buyer might oversee 50 categories, each with thousands of SKUs within it. At almost every major chain, that buyer is also rotated into a new category every year or two, an intentional destabilizing strategy to keep them from making personal relationships with multi-billion-dollar ag companies that historically start to offer outright bribes as soon as a personal relationship is formed. Footnote. Of course, as one buyer said when I mentioned this aside, You think it's only the big guys offering bribes? Payoffs are everywhere, and the little guys are often the worst. End footnote. This might make for a good business move, preventing a glut of overpriced ConAgra products, but it also prevents the buyer from ever getting any deep knowledge about the categories they are covering. I keep running into these buyers that are just bewildered, an old-school food manufacturer tells me. They don't know competing items in their category. They don't know the supply chain. They don't even know price. All good people, but completely overwhelmed and confused by the volume they're now responsible for. A buyer for Roche Brothers Supermarkets, a small 20-store chain in the Northeast, tells me he averages 30 to 40 cold calls per day. This on top of 6 to 8 hours of scheduled meetings. Buyers at Whole Foods National are sent 500 new products per month. There is very little time for considering details or nuance or investigating the product beyond the superficials of the pitch meeting. And when they do consider details, flavor and quality are not first or even third-level considerations. I see a lot of young entrepreneurs too locked into recipe, the name of the product, the packaging. That should not be on the radar screen in the beginning, Annette Dunlap, an agribusiness consultant who helps launch new food companies, explains. You need to understand your costs. You need to understand the needs of your store. Stop thinking about food, Ian says. Think like a buyer, then problem solve based on a buyer's needs. And if you are lucky and everything goes right, at the end of that meeting, they'll throw you a bone and let you give them free product. The crack, a crack, just crack. Once you agree to ship that free product, we have statistics. Just over 20,000 new products hit the shelf each year. 89% of those fail within 18 months. It is a reaping. To understand this rate of failure, the failure of the products that got their act together enough to succeed, you have to understand one big thing that most starting food entrepreneurs do not. Grocery does not just make its money off people buying things in its stores. It makes its money off its vendors. To make sense of this, let's return to our buyer. He's charged with a small fiefdom to administer. This is his category, a strip of shelving or fridge or freezer space he can manipulate as he sees fit. Maybe it's that 12 to 24 feet of yogurt almost every grocery store in America features. A buyer does not see cultured milk when he looks at this territory. He's not taste test samples side by side looking for the richest and creamiest product to stock there. Instead, he sees and tastes reams of data. The performance of each subcategory, Greek, non-dairy, liquid, multipack, singles, broken down into discrete metrics according to basket share, seasonality, volume per price per promotion, or just a plain old vanilla UPSPW, units per store per week. He scans all that data on the printout his analyst gives him, but then puts one big hairy eyeball on the two numbers at the end, total sales dollars and gross profit. Those matter 50 times more than everything else. They are the metrics that keep his boss happy. And what matters most of all is that he can grow those numbers year to year. Footnote. Every buyer I spoke with talked about the passion of the entrepreneur as being an extremely important factor in their decision making. But how they qualified this passion is telling, allowing us to see the precise and slightly skewed manner buyers relate to food and new food product trends. When buyers talked about passionate suppliers, it wasn't because they believed in their passion per se, though that certainly helps. Buyers are not machines, at least not yet. It's because they see it as a leading indicator. Two different buyers I talked to brought up the passion around GMO-free products. That is, foods without any genetically modified ingredients. They talked about their attraction to these passionate founders who would light up pitch meetings with their drive for change and genuine commitment to transparency in the supply chain. But both these buyers noted that they didn't believe in the specific controversy around GMOs, one buyer calling it climate change for the left. But this buyer felt that the passion in his GMO-free suppliers was a conduit to the desires in his customers. That as makers and designers, suppliers were sensitive to trends before they came to his attention. So he valued their passion, but in a special, almost sociopathic sense. Passion was a marker he didn't want to ignore, even if he remained completely detached from its substance. End footnote. Here, he has options. He can look for new, exciting products, or at least ones with longer shelf life and higher gross margins that he can use to replace the weaker, scrawnier SKUs in his herd. Or he can try to change his mix, creating offerings that nudge consumers in certain profitable directions by, say, eliminating a high-quality private label line that might be stealing sales from more expensive traditional options. Or he can lean hard on his existing suppliers, relying on their increasing efficiency. For example, the miraculous ability of their trucking carriers to reduce cost. Whatever the means, it's not his concern as long as they agree to shave off a few pennies per 100 pounds to inch up his margins. But all those options are time intensive. The first are risky. The last, interpersonally demanding and conflict heavy. And so he takes a third path, an almost effortless, inexhaustible way to grow his gross profit, which requires no time or risk on his part. He simply demands a payment from the young entrepreneurs who come to his office in exchange for putting their items on his shelf. The entrepreneurs are desperate. They're probably already leveraged, and so what's a little more debt to them? They also have no hope of return if their item is not on a shelf. And if every buyer in the industry begins to do the same thing, they really have no choice. It's crack, Earl Schweitzer, the former head of grocery for Whole Foods, tells me. Every buyer is addicted. You charge a fee, and it gets added to the budget. Every year, you're expected to bring in more. This is serious money. It can bail you out if you're in a mess. Often, there's no return for the supplier. It's essentially extractive. The euphemism is trade spend. And it's an area of the industry nobody wants to talk about too loudly because it's so murky and backward. The idea that the best products are on the shelf, rather than, say, the producers who ponied up the biggest bucks, benefits the supplier and the store. And what the customer doesn't know can't hurt them. At heart, it's a pay-to-play system. Don't have the money, you don't get to play, Lisa Curtis, CEO of Cooley Cooley Foods, tells me. Life on the shelf is ruthless. You are fighting, fighting, fighting. But not just your competitors. You're fighting to survive the store itself. In its simplest form, this trade spend comes as a, quote, slotting fee, which is a pure cash-for-placement exchange. The buyer asks for money. In return, you get inches on the shelf. Not a special end cap display, not a center spot right at eye level, just inches somewhere. These payments amount to $9 billion a year in industry profit. To get a sense of how lucrative these can be for an individual store, in January 2017, one national retailer was charging $55,000 for 22 by 12 inches of shelf space for a single month. This is a retailer likely operating on those industry-wide 1.5 to 3% gross margins, so we're talking rocket fuel to their bottom line. But slotting fees are nothing. They're so transparent and obvious that many retailers have moved away from them. In their place, a mad inventive spree of different taxes and extractive demands has emerged. There are, quote, promotional fees, subsidizing the cost of a two-for-one deal, tag sales, or other discounts. There's, quote, free fill, a free case, or 10, in each flavor for the retailer to sell at 100% profit. There are, quote, advertising fees for unwanted but mandatory placement in the company's internal newsletter, a promotion that almost no one will read and will produce no benefits. Or fees for receiving the privilege of being broadcast on their, quote, radio network, a network that consists of interrupting whatever Muzak is bopping in their in-store speakers to announce your product. There are negotiations around the length of credit. There are payments for waste, spoilage, or just because your product that they bought doesn't sell. There are mandatory, quote, requests that you use their specific overpriced proprietary supply chain, quote, solutions. Or, as a consultant tells me, you must pay for our style of barcode, despite the fact that it costs two times the normal amount and the difference disappears into our pocket. Fees for package redesign or store-mandated market research. There are fees on top of fees, and every movement or change offers new opportunities. Money's demanded when the retailer opens a new store, refurbishes an existing one, when a competitor opens up nearby, when the category gets its annual overhaul. To be clear, as a supplier, you would never be hit with all of these fees at once. Just bitten slyly, occasionally. The precise charges will vary year to year and retailer to retailer. But in each case, you as a supplier are directly contributing to the store's gross profit. People don't realize Costco isn't providing those demos. Whole Foods isn't paying for the second one you get free, an entrepreneur tells me. It's mandated. Companies are spending thousands and thousands of dollars to get their foot in the door. The retailer loves it because it makes the shopping experience more fun, but the young supplier is often bleeding. Ian Keller, co-founder of Peeled, tells me, it's a huge initial startup cost. I entered into several stupid deals. We paid about $1,000 per store for 18 stores out west. They slotted us on the top shelf, which means nobody sees you, and they put us in the wrong category. This was Peeled, a vegetable snack, and they put us in baking. Then we spent another $2,000 to sample in their stores. And in less than 6 months, they pulled us. We were out with no relationship. They kept everything. At this point, I'm over it, he continues. The only bone I have to pick is with myself for ignorance. But it could have destroyed us, and I've seen it destroy other companies. They were cynically exploiting our desperation to get on shelf. In 2015, trade spend added up to about $76 billion taken in by retailers. It was the number two cost for an entrepreneur, below only the cost of raw goods, far above more traditional costs like packaging, production, distribution, or advertising. And a 2011 Nielsen study suggests that 55% of this spending is extractive, failing to grow the brand. All these loans from aunts and uncles dribbled away. I don't bring this up to bash retailers. In many ways, they've simply quietly reinvented their business model. At this point, trade spend has become so pervasive that every responsible vendor includes it in their budget. So it's only when retailers exceed the 12 to 18% standard that it really becomes destructive. Further, when used responsibly in a joint effort with the supplier to grow sales, they're extremely productive forms of trade spend. Promotions, discounts, and demos are tools that can get new products into minds and carts. End caps, which almost always require a promotional fee, have been shown to increase sales more than 500%. But the wrong type of trade spend, especially when targeted at the rookie food entrepreneur who's most vulnerable, is destructive. It also has long-term effects on the food we buy and who's able to sell it. It creates conditions where innovation doesn't break in or spread easily. It pushes retailers away from the Joe Colon model of building food expertise into the more abstract position of seeing food as a financial instrument. And in general, it makes the entire system far riskier for the entrepreneur. Frozen and Refrigerated Buyer, an industry trade, estimates the cost of national rollout for even a single frozen SKU at $1.5 million. It all combines to create a squeeze play. You take out massive loans to play with the big boys, usually selling major portions of control to venture capital. Or you stay tiny, unable to break in. Footnote. This risk factor is compounded quite significantly by the distributor. If by hook, crook, and slotting fee, your new product ends up on the shelf at Target, woohoo! But then it doesn't sell, and the distributor charges you and takes it off the shelf? This is called chargeback, and it's a standard part of most distribution contracts. You now not only have a ton of unsold product, inventory that was supposed to be out there selling, you have to pay the cost of getting it back. There is no opportunity to grow slowly. Instead, each part of the system compounds risk, escalating a small mistake into a bankruptcy. End footnote. The longer you're with a buyer, the more they're going to come to you for money, Ian tells me. If you're making money, they're going to ask for a piece of it. It's not how the consumer thinks about the grocery store, but it's how the manufacturer needs to think about it. Ian is wound up at this point. The founder of Chobani was not the first person to introduce Greek yogurt to the American market. He had the financial backing from his family, and wow, that was crucial. Every year, there's a category with a pioneer entering, someone with a great vision and a great product who just gets wiped out. It makes the entire industry a gamble, and the last few years, with venture capital flooding in, the price of the gamble has gone so far up, I'm afraid we're going to lose an entire generation of our most creative entrepreneurs. In the winter of 2012, Julie makes her first sale. Ingles Market, a local chain just a short 100-mile drive from her home, takes a flyer after she repeatedly drives over to pitch them. From Ingles, she gets the cred to approach a number of small independents. At each one, when she's asked for slotting fees, Julie responds with the honest truth that she simply cannot afford them. A lot of retailers said, if you don't put the money up or you don't give us a free case, then we can't put you in, she tells me. Hey, I accept that. But my response is, I'm going to grow my business at your competitor's location. I tell them, let me be your partner. Let me give you something more meaningful than money. And Julie is certainly ready to give in alternative ways. The more time I spend with her, the more I realize she runs on generosity. It is energizing and anxiety-producing, this benevolence as fuel. Watching someone give and give right up to the point where you wonder about nullification, wonder whether she's literalizing selflessness and or giving until there's absolutely nothing left. It also is remarkable to receive. I will send Julie a short email with a question about distribution channels, and Julie will bang out a 4-page reply, complete with references, personal asides, and a list of contacts who might know more. She will get back to me that night. She will follow up a few days later to see if I had questions now that I've digested. This is not special treatment. I see her do it repeatedly for others, strangers she meets through Facebook, a woman who comes up after an entrepreneurship panel. At one trade show in New York, a woman who drove down from New England to volunteer for Julie grips my shoulder so her fingers push towards bone and whispers, "She's amazing." Message received. But what's incredible is that I understand the intensity of that woman's awe. And it's all channeled into a single product. Slossa is the fulcrum from which her generosity swings, the universal donor to conversations with strangers. Where is that? Long Island? Oh, Slossa's at a Stop and Shop there. The gateway to physical strength. Julie's shoulders are ripped in the way of the fitness model, but not from endless side planks, rather from lugging her shoulder strap bag full of sample product. And the source of endless, if questionable, cocktail trivia. Did you know Polish people consume 3 times as much cabbage as Americans? It's a real shame, because back in the 1920s, we consumed 22 pounds per person. Her day starts with Slossa at 6 a.m. when she flips open her laptop in the dark, before the dogs are awake, and begins jamming out emails. It ends with Julie a few feet from where she started, at a tiny desk in an alcove in her suburban living room, a quarter pallet of Slossa stacked beside her, her dogs back asleep again, pushing the laptop down to get some rest. Very little of this work involves food, or food production, or flavor. The work of the food entrepreneur is marketing. If a popular family blogger writes about her breast cancer, Julie will ping her with a medical journal article that might interest her readers, linking lower cancer rates to cruciferous vegetable consumption. If the blogger responds, Julie might send a jar of Slossa with that one particular cruciferous vegetable, cabbage, highlighted on the ingredients list. If a morning TV host anywhere in America mentions they like to grill, Julie will have a sample of Slossa en route by mid-afternoon, always with a handwritten note, always ending with the scrawled sign-off, "Stay Slossom," or maybe we're only 3 months away from National Barbecue Day. If so, Julie's busy pitching local nutritionists in different affiliate regions, loading them up with pitch docs of their own so they can offer their services to local TV stations for a segment on how we as a nation can have a healthier barbecue on National Barbecue Day. A segment Julie conceived for the sole purpose that it may or may not allow the nutritionist to debate the merits of mayonnaise and coleslaw, and thus perhaps offer an aside about Slossa as a healthier alternative. Footnote. Hanging out with Julie, I get a true understanding of exactly how many of these moronic commemorative days exist out there, speckling our calendars with the legislative equivalent of pigeon shit, as if legislators had nothing better to do all day than to sit and roost above our calendars, caking them. To take a date entirely at random, the day I'm writing this, November 1st, is National Calzone Day, National Authors Day, National Family Literacy Day, National Cook for Your Pets Day, National Vinegar Day, National Deep Fried Clams Day, National Brush Day, and National Stress Awareness Day. This is not a joke. In some smug pagan lobbyist vision of the world, we would all donate 5 minutes from our lives each November 1st to reflect on brushes and calzones and the rest. Of course, hanging with Julie, I see their manic profusion as shockingly useful. "You have to know your days. That's basic," she tells me. "For instance, I know National Crab Cake Day is tomorrow. It has nothing to do with Slossa, but I made a pretty damn good crab cake recipe that has Slossa in it. It's very moist." End footnote. It is always opportunity by giving someone else an opportunity, the natural medium of all PR. But Julie understands it on an intuitive level. She lives it. This most American mixture of sincerity and manipulation, opposites bound up by the energy of this tiny, cheerful dynamo, helping people in the hope that it might help Slossa, I'm alternately awed and troubled and always have to refrain from taking advantage. At this point, Julie's sole conduit to actual food is her co-packer. She uses Golding Farms, which is housed in a cavernous cement building off the side of I-40. That is not the least bit farm, but is run by a Mr. Tony Golding. Tony bought a small canning operation in 1972 and used it to begin churning out his own line of salad dressings and steak sauces. The Golding brand is a modest local success. I see the full lineup at a nearby Piggly Wiggly when I visit, looking a little dusty, in metaphor if not fact, 2 shelves below all the national brands. But over the years, Tony has expanded his facilities considerably. He has always been methodical about modernizing his operations, and with each upgrade, the ever longer strides of technology meant that soon he was capable of producing far more output than he could ever need. And so slowly, Tony's business model evolved from manufacturing his own product to selling time on his line and manufacturing the products of others. The day I walk into his plant, the whole place is stinking of fermented soy, and I see an unending stream of tiny, unlabeled bottles of black liquid chattering forth on the conveyors below us. They are destined to become a variety of Kikkoman soy sauce once the labeler hits them, that ubiquitous national brand found in sushi restaurants everywhere. Most national manufacturers contract out work like this. They optimize their own in-house facility for a single item, that core brand-defining mayonnaise or classic marinara, needed in extreme volume. Then they contract with smaller facilities like Tony's to make the offshoots, the garlic mayo, or the puttanesca that would waste the talents of an industrial line so specialized and massive. Golding Farms does a lot of private label. Grocers come to them with an idea, perhaps some new salad dressing they've seen and want to bring in-house. They then work with their team of food scientists and industrial chefs to create a parallel product, one that Golding Farms makes, but the grocer sells under their own proprietary label. Footnote. This brings up a point that requires mentioning, even if it's a little dry. The rise of private label in the post-Joe Colomb world, where retailers attempt to make not just cheaper generics, but own-label products that are rivals in quality to the national brands, has occurred simultaneously with this outsourcing of manufacturing duties by national brands. And these two trends have collided in the facilities of co-packers like Golding Farms, placing them at the center of a latent, never-verbalized ethical quandary that is basically impossible to negotiate, but which has completely tipped the balance of power in the grocery industry away from powerful brands like Kraft's, Campbell's, etc., and towards powerful retailers like Costco, Kroger's, etc. The intellectual property involved in creating successful branded products is huge, time-consuming, and costly, but by definition must be shared in its most nude, vulnerable details, from pricing decisions to unique processes, with the third-party producer whose assembly line will actually be making it. At the same time, retailers are no fools, can read between the proverbial chains of supply, and will approach the very co-packers who specialize in the national branded products they want to replicate on their own, beseeching Tony and his team of food scientists to help them design a product that is similar, but even better than the national brand he may or may not also be making. All the NDAs and secrecy in the world start to fail here, because the point of convergence is the same facility, perhaps even the same industrial chef, and thus the retail manufacturers get to draft off the speed of the national manufacturers and their R&D, making similar products at a cost structure that suits them. Naturally, nobody at Golding Farms wants to talk about any of this stuff when I ask, and the conversation quickly falls back on old saws like respecting the integrity of relationships, trust, and a family-run business, and of course pointing at legal NDAs. But even with the best intentions, there is an effect, and the last 20 years have seen a fantastic rise in the negotiating power of major supermarkets for precisely this reason. End footnote. In the best-case scenario, a facility like Golding Farms can then use these larger clients to update and expand their machinery, taking on debt for that expansion, knowing the big runs will keep them profitable. But in practice, especially with bigger brands that have the financing to contract with competing facilities simultaneously, it also leaves them vulnerable. There's always someone out there who's willing to do it cheaper, Kent Vickery, the Golding Farms plant manager, tells me. They'll come to a supermarket and say, "I know you're buying Golding Farms steak sauce. I'll sell you a similar thing for 20 cents a bottle less." Now, this facility may actually be losing money on that steak sauce or coming close, but they're just trying to get their foot in the door. And that's a compelling argument for a buyer. And so, to hedge against this squeeze, Golding Farms maintains an essential fourth strand of work: co-packing for the Julie Bouchers of the world. Co-packing is essentially outsourcing all aspects of a fledgling business's food production. It allows Julie to focus exclusively on marketing and growing her brand, without the insanity of trying to run her own factory. In terms of line time, Julie might be a riskier proposition for Golden Farms, but she isn't going to nickel and dime them. She isn't capable. And if they bet properly, as her needs grow, she'll take over more of their capacity at that great rate. At the same time, using a co-packer allows dreamers like Julie to move their baby at national scale without knowing a lick about what it takes to actually make her product at national scale. In return, she merely needs to dream in a very specific, industry-mandated manner that allows manufacturing efficiencies to accumulate. Golding Farms can fill just about any bottle with just about any substance, liquid, food, paste. In an industry where production is often optimized for volume, this flexibility is its own advantage, allowing them to match, say, a Slossa run with their own Golding Farms brand Coleslaw run with a private label run that also requires bulk bell peppers. even though Julie might only require a single 8-hour shift every 6 months, and 8 hours that disgorges more than 90,000 jars of salsa that she'll have to place in stores, the convergence of ingredients combined with the minimal adjustments to the production facility allow them to offer her a competitive price. "It's a big chess game," Kent explains. "I can make a certain amount of money off each of these different pieces. Some match each other perfectly. Some offer reliability. You only have so many hours in the day. So who do you spend your time on?" "People might come to us and say, 'We want Clorox in a bottle,'" he continues. "Now, could we do that? Of course. Would we? It would have to stand on its own merits. We'd have to price it out. The cleaning, the shutdown of the line. Nothing we're currently producing is even close to that. But right now, coconut oil has been so popular. All the national retailers are saying, 'Hey, can you private label this for us?' We can do it, but does it fit?" These pressures are a structural reason for all those waves and fads you see in food. There is enormous manufacturing incentive to conform. "Listen, if we're trying to work out a co-packing deal and I have to get cocoa powder from Cairo for your product, that's not so easy. It's probably not something I'm using for any of my other products," Kent says. But once an ingredient breaks into the supply chain, placing it into other food becomes significantly easier. "That is definitely something we think about. Okay, I'm sourcing this. Well, now it's worth it to put it in everything else." And suddenly, avocado oil gets worked into everything, from popcorn to crackers to mayonnaise. When we walk the floor, decked in snowy white hair caps, snowy white beard protectors, and long white nylon gowns, a troop of ghosts inside a literal machine, the immensity of our desire as a species weighs down. Golding Farms is a small to mid-sized facility, but it is unlike anything I've ever seen before. 205,000 square feet of manufacturing space, whirling with machines, all working in powerful physical incantation. The speed and complexity of the line, bottles ratcheting up so they blur together beaded, robots swiveling to cap them in never-ending precision, expands the mind almost like meditation. It is enveloping and deafening, and as we walk through, every one of us sinks our necks a little lower into our shoulders in acknowledgement of the added pressure in the air. Unlike so many other industrial spaces I've visited while researching this book, it smells like food. The line is impeccably clean, polished cement and shined up stainless steel, not so much as a stray drop from the thrashing machines just inches away. Instead of smelling like machinery, the space is sweet and heavy and makes me oddly hungry. The muckraker in me wishes I could write about dirty conditions or workers throwing themselves off from the scaffolding into bubbling vats to escape their drudgery. But alas, this was simply not the case. Instead, my overriding memory of Golding Farms is of order and precision, and of almost perfect cleanliness, a cleanliness that really did hearken to godliness, if only in its approach to an absolute state of being. Eventually, after following the line upstream, we arrive at the beginning. This is a pantry area, but pantry for the gods. Shelving units 30 feet high are packed with giant drums labeled, quote, spicy mustard, or, quote, caramel color, or, quote, honey, or, quote, garlic. On the floor, we pass 2,000 pounds of granulated sugar in a bag about the size of a twin mattress, next to a 12 by 12 foot pen of cabbage. I put the quotes around the, quote, garlic and other pantry items not to be snotty, but because, excepting the cabbage, none of these ingredients are what we use at home. They are industrial analogs, produced and designed for machines at volume, not for pots and pans at a home stove. On the floor next to us, we pass two penguin-sized bottles of something called aqua clove and aqua allspice. You might say, I use some vinegar to make this sauce at home. But that just doesn't work here, Ken explains. We need ingredients that are more precise, more consistent, and with better shelf life. A half cup of your vinegar, when you start doing it at 600 gallons, simply doesn't mirror. It wouldn't taste right. This mirroring reveals a final industry truth. As a co-packer, Golding Farms is a soup-to-nuts operation. If you're capable of handling their thresholds, i.e. ready to graduate from a commercial kitchen, they'll work with your product at every stage, from recipe design to shipping. And once you sign off on their decisions, they will handle all those details for you, working to source every major input from ingredients to glassware. I could never in a million years get the prices they get, Julie tells me, so I just piggyback off them. In practice, this places the power and responsibility for negotiating quality standards in the hands of these facilities. That is, whether the ingredients coming in are local, organic, ethically compliant, comes down to how co-packers source and how well they are held accountable for third-party inspections. Golding Farms seemed like exquisitely respectable people. I don't think they would have let me in the door if they weren't both proud and confident in the products they were making. When I asked about audits, they kept accurately pointing out this was not the type of cleanliness you could suddenly fake. But they also seemed concerned by the overall dynamics at play in the industry. They knew better than anyone that audits were largely paper with no teeth, and that despite all the extra work they were doing, a contract largely came down to trust. They saw and spoke freely about how competitors who were less honorable could exploit that trust, and worse, how buyers who were under bottom-line pressure might blink and unconsciously collaborate with those suppliers to give themselves a deal. Retailers rely on us to maintain the quality of the food, Kent says. For instance, the industry standard for local is 40% local ingredients. But nobody regulates that. Nobody. At Golding Farms, we do buy our ingredients for local runs in North Carolina. But does everybody? Who would know? For retail buyers already overwhelmed by logistics, there's a compounding effect of all these lean efficiencies. I'm stressed, you're stressed, and my stress actually pushes me to ignore any unease around what you're saying and instead enthusiastically accept this lower price you're only able to offer me because you're cutting corners due to your stress. At this point, buying is an international market, Kent continues. There are a lot of concerns that we didn't have to worry about before. Fraud is a very real thing, and the sourcing of products comes through an incredible number of channels. We sent people to China when we were considering buying ingredients there, and we decided we couldn't buy in China, or at least not from the suppliers we visited. They were cheaper, but how often could we reasonably check on their quality? On the other hand, if you're one of those guys trying to knock out a price, get your foot in the door, that's exactly the type of ingredient you might source. On the way back from Golding Farms, we pass a supermarket, and Julie announces, "I'm going in to check on my jars. I'd like to take a picture for the website." So we pull off the highway, hop out of the Ford, and head in. Julie walking across the parking lot at about 1.5 times normal speed, her pace increasing the closer we get to the store, as if pulled by proximity, by the lure of her baby. And then the glass doors open, and I see it all with her eyes. An utterly drab supermarket transformed into pure anxiety. Products all yelling at the top of their lungs from the shelves for attention. Naked competition of the type you don't typically see except for wildlife documentaries or middle school recess. As I'm processing this, Julie is moving up and down the aisles with long, quick strides, a look of perplexed concern on her face. You never know quite how big a supermarket is until you're searching inside one for a few bottles of Slossa with their producer. The variety of similar but not exact items is staggering. "I'm not really worried about competition," she tells me as we stalk the aisles. "It takes General Mills about 4 years to knock off a product like this. The mid-sized guys, they worry me a little. But the big guys, they'd rather buy you out before they'd knock you off." I'm nodding and panting, trailing Julie. Her speed has increased now that her first attempt to find Slossa in the produce department failed. We head to the meat section, Julie's next best hunch, and see plastic bags of coleslaw snuggled against coiled sausages, a promising adjacency. "Those big guys, they're companies of brands," she continues, "dozens and dozens of brands, so adding one more isn't very risky for them." Julie is pawing past jars in a pickle display, double-checking to see if there's any Slossa behind them as she says this. We walk away from the meat, Julie wrinkling her nose, maybe an annoyance, maybe to sniff out her Slossa among the chaos of this store. "A big guy can do a buy one, get one free, but not me. I can't discount it a full 50%. I don't have the money, and it'll put in the wrong perception to consumers. I can't cheapen my brand." We stop abruptly. "Oh, up there with the kimchi. That would make sense." Julie's frozen like a pointer, eyes scanning the shelves of one of those quintessentially American ethnic aisles where the Mexican green chilies are packed next to the black fish sauce of Southeast Asia. But there's no Slossa. Let's go back to the produce. I know I've seen it there. We spend the next 10 minutes spinning around the produce aisle. I know this precise feeling well, losing something I just know I have and don't particularly need to find, and feeling the anxiety of the search rising in my chest the longer I can't find it. Here in the produce department, Julie is lifting the figurative cushions on the couch and on her literal knees to scope out the lowest shelf. And then suddenly, there it is, in the local section, a subcategory within produce, three rows of Slossa. Original, spicy, and fire, on the lowest shelf of a fairly shabby display made out of used slatted boxes. Julie's clearly disappointed. I feel embarrassed to be there all of a sudden and want to give her a hug, though she'd no doubt be horrified by even the idea. "I'm okay," she says. "I don't need to take a picture. It's here." And we head right out the entrance doors, back to the parking lot, triumphant at finding it, dejected from the search, our pace slowing back to normal the farther we move away. At some undefined moment, Julie's buyer meetings began to produce results. I thought, should I reach out to Walmart just to make sure they know we exist? And after spending 4 months to research price, Julie approached them. Rather than just acknowledging her existence, Walmart placed an order. Then Kroger bought in. Then Safeway got excited. Julie stopped driving to stores and instead built out a network of brokers, agents who would rep Sloss on commission, who had pre-existing relationships with buyers, who could give her sales data about how her items performed on the shelf. But the better the news, the greater the pressure. Her spending increased with each production run, and she now had to manage the team of brokers on top of her marketing work. And so right around the time she signed with Kroger in 2015, Julie started taking sleeping pills. She hadn't been sleeping well for months, but suddenly it got to the point where even a single hour escaped her. "I just lay there thinking," she says. "My brain wouldn't stop. I'd get up and make a giant list of all the things I needed to do the next day to release the stress." Unfortunately, even the medication did nothing. And so for months, Julie would slip out of bed at 4 a.m., shaking her head as she walked around her house in the dark, trying hard not to wake her husband or the dogs. Then she'd stare at her to-do list in a pool of yellow light on her living room desk and count up the hours she was getting back by not sleeping. That made her feel a little better. Then she'd sit down and get back to work. Over the next 2 years, something very unexpected started happening. Things began to fall into place. Influential blogger Hungry Girl, author of 6 New York Times best-selling cookbooks, gets a hold of Slossa and names it one of her best low-calorie condiments, and then follows that up with a best health food product. Walmart slowly expands her product into more and more stores. Then Lowe's Home Improvement decides to feature Slossa next to their grills. Buyers return her calls quicker. She hires more brokers in more regions. And then, just a few months after we were frantically searching for her product in the aisles of her own local supermarket, Julie hits PR pay dirt. On some forgotten Tuesday, Dylan Dreyer, co-host and resident foodie on NBC's Today Show, professes her love of relish on air. And Julie, reflexively, instinctively, sends out one of her thousands upon thousands of routine, sincere, handwritten notes affixed to a jar of Slossa. And somehow, this does not get lost, or discarded, or eaten with a spoon by some lonely, overworked PA, but instead gets tasted and enjoyed by none other than Dylan Dreyer herself, backstage in her dressing room. And she promptly orders more. And so suddenly, on July 14th, Bastille Day for some, but National Hot Dog Day for those in the know, the Today Show anchors, in a perfect row of smiling faces behind their anchor desk, chow down on hot dogs positively smothered in Slossa. It is the number one rated morning show at the time. Co-host Natalie Morales gushes as she chews. Dylan Dreyer comes up for air and says, almost befuddled, "I said relish on the air one time, and this company sends me this. It's like everything I love in one jar." And she says this, holding Julie's baby in her hands, label facing out at today's 4.5 million viewers. So blatant a plug, it almost looks staged, except for the other two hosts are pigging out at this point, saying things like, "I love this, Slossa. How good is this?" And we see Al Roker shaking the whole goddamn jar out on his hot dog like he's trying to bury the thing, exclaiming, "This is fantastic. What a great idea," between chewed mouthfuls. And it's obvious this is not a staged display of enthusiasm at all. Julie basks. It feels like a dream. Around that time, though entirely unrelated, Progressive Grocer, the leading grocery trade magazine, names her winner of their Top Woman in Grocery Award for the executive category. This doesn't do a thing for her sales, but it does signify respect and that people in the industry have been watching her hustle. She is on stage with women from the major CPGs, executives of true multinational, multi-million dollar companies. Kroger expands her line. Suddenly, Slossa, which was in all of 0 stores when she got involved, can be found in over 8,000. It is sold cross-country, including 3 different chains in Alaska, and Julie starts fielding offers to get it into the Australian and German markets. She tells me in an email offhand, as an aside, "I'm still not taking a salary, but I've started meeting up with friends again." The last time I see Julie in action, we are back at the fancy food show. This is 2.5 years after our first meeting, on the other side of the country, at the sister show in New York. Julie's in another small booth off the main hall. Even for booths, I'm guessing there's a slotting fee she refused to pay. She stands, hair pinned back, smile affixed hard, but I notice something new in her enthusiasm. There's a calm to it. And she's dressed slightly fancier. Her smart suits upgraded to something almost unslossa, something sleek. Are those pearls in her ears? As I approach, Julie's trying to hammer out new deals to move Slossa beyond retail into her next frontier, food service. That is, selling directly to restaurants, cafeterias, hospitals, and stadiums so that Slossa might sit on the table or get spat out of a pump anywhere you want a relish alternative. She also has two mentees who are helping her run the booth, both found from a Facebook entrepreneurship page she now administers. As they wait for passerbys to approach, the two holding serving trays like caterers, Julie gives them their compensation in the form they most want. Advice. You can't think of food service as a money-making channel, Julie tells them. The margins are so low, it's basically marketing. But that's exactly why it's important. People will eat Slossa at the places they love. And then when they see it on the shelf, of course they'll pick it up. Plus, it's consistent business. As long as you're pricing it right, you might not be making much money, but you're keeping your volume up with your co-packer, which is a way of honoring that relationship. The women nod, their trays bobbing slightly along with their heads. Can't you see Slossa at the ballpark? She asks. And suddenly, I can, with an exciting clarity. Even the amateurish lettering on the logo is starting to make retroactive sense. It looks like an old-timey ballpark script. It's like Julie has dreamt long enough and hard enough that she's changed my imagination and the very way I see her product. Lost puppy dog, no more. As the day continues, I can see, however, that despite the sleeker suits, she is still very Julie. When a vegetarian comes by and accidentally eats a nugget of hot dog with her Slossa, Julie scrambles for a napkin so the woman can spit it out into her waiting hands. That accomplished, Julie closes up the little mound of half-chewed food into a napkin canapé, tosses it no look into a trash can in the corner, and a smooth swivel worthy of a Golding Farms robot presents a fresh meat-free cup for the woman. Beep, beep, beep. Come back here. You still have to taste. Slossa is the perfect topping for all things vegetarian. A man walks right up between both of them and sticks his face real close. What is this stuff? Some type of pizza topping? Before Julie can answer, he ambles off. No, no, sir, not a pizza topping, she says to no one in particular. But then she arches her eyebrows, stands with her hands clasped, looking off into the distance. I can see Julie's brain turning, trying to figure out if it makes sense. Not a traditional pizza topping, at least, she giggles at last. The vegetarian swallows her dose, smiles at Julie placidly, and continues on. Later, I hear Julie laughing with a long-haired dude about Slossa on fish tacos. And after that, laughing with an older man about Slossa on his wife's deviled eggs. When a vendor hawking some form of marinated pork loin stops by, Julie turns to me. Every time I see meat, I get so excited. That is what Slossa is made for. Eventually, we have a moment alone. No mentees, no samples to be given out. I point out her clothes, tell her she's looking more relaxed than I've ever seen her. At first, she says nothing. Then slowly, with great relief, I made my last payment to my former partner for the buyout, she says. Just this month. That was the last of the big hurdles. Now we can start building up our savings again. If my husband had lost his job at any point over the last 7 years, she puts her hand on one of the jars of Slossa, taps the top with her fingers instead of finishing the thought. I wouldn't say I feel comfortable, but I'm no longer worried about being one of those 89% who get on the shelf and still fail. You know, we're here. She picks up a jar and holds it in her hand, then sets it back down. Did I tell you I'm playing tennis? Exercise. That's new. She gets a wicked gleam in her eye. Turns out I'm pretty good. Beat the pants off my husband. Ran out of gals in the area to play. Just then, a group of chunky men with clipboards roll up. It's late in the show, and everyone's a little tired. The man in the center of the group has his badge twisted over, the front facing his belly, ostentatiously hiding his identity. Basically the only signifier of the true VIPs here. So what is this Slossa, he says. Julie whisks away from me, sticks out a hand. What is Slossa, she says, drawing out the question long and delicious. Slossa is the condiment that will change your life.